notes, and we'll just plow through as much as we possibly can. A reminder that on Monday, Dr. Ed Lutessa from the University of Cincinnati will be joining us, as well as Dave Furlmeyer, who will be making some comments about his experiencing the criminal justice system over time and how public safety system impacts other things like higher education, et cetera. So that being said, why don't you guys pick up where you left off?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Max Williams, Director of the Department of Corrections. What I've asked everyone to do today in the interest of the committee's time was to really focus just on the details of what their divisions are doing, and then specifically performance measures that tie to the policy option packages that we're requesting today to try to utilize your time in the most effective fashion. So Mr. Kresge will kick off, and then we'll just see how far we can get.
Great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Kresge, Assistant Director for General Services of the Department of Corrections. What I would propose in light of that is that I don't spend a lot of time on the budget drivers since most of what's left in my budget drivers really covers two of the main themes that I've already talked about, and that's the growth of the department, the demand for our services, as well as our aging infrastructure. And that the next section is performance measures, and so what I'd like to do there is just highlight a couple of the performance measures that tie back to our policy packages, and then spend the balance of my time really talking about our policy packages. So that works for you, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay. So if you'd like to, we'll go by the budget drivers then, and go to slide 42. In this section, we list the internal performance measures that the division uses for to manage our operation. And this particular one is the is within fiscal services. And this number of years out of the last five, the agency earned the State of Controllers Division Gold Star certificate. And what's important about this is that even though this is a one-year event, annual financial report. What's important here to keep in mind is that there's activities that have to go on throughout the year in order to position ourselves and be ready to respond to that annual financial report in a way that then earns us that star. And those are things like that expenditures are recorded correctly and within the correct time periods, that reconciliations are done timely, and that receivables are promptly recorded. The next performance measure that I'd like to talk about is on slide 43, it's the next slide over. That's the percent of time payments are made timely according to the statute, policy, and contract. What we're measuring there is that we get payments done within a 45-day period. That's according to statute, policy, and contract. And you can see there in that measure that for various reasons, while we have improved over the last few quarters, we still are not reaching our target. While we have reorganized to try to make some improvements, we still have trouble keeping the pace. And I'll address this a little bit further when we talk about policy option package 120 in terms of how we...
Just above Representative Hannah.
Thank you. Could you just give us briefly the top three reasons why?
Well, essentially, I can give you probably the top couple reasons, I guess. One is that, again, it goes back to that growth issue. That as we grow, there's just more activity. More contracts, more payments to make to vendors. As we develop more programs, and we just have more people to pay. The second really that's really associated with that is our staffing level. As I showed you back in early on in my presentation, as the population has grown, our staffing has actually, in some cases, declined. And where that's declined is in our central support areas, particularly, as I'll talk about in Package 20, or 120, in the areas of fiscal services and information services.
And just to follow up?
Yes.
So there's a couple of reasons that you're struggling to do it. Now give us a couple of things you've done to mitigate those problems.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, what we've done is look at our processes. We've looked at other activities that we've been involved in, and we've reprioritized the placement of staff so that we concentrate on those on that particular area, the payment area, because the issue there is that if we're behind in payments, there is an incentive for us, obviously, to make the payment on time, because if we're late, then there's an additional charge that's often applied to that payment. So the main thing that we've done is looked at other activities and moved staff over to be able to concentrate on this area. Thank you. The other areas that I would like to talk about, the other measures, is information systems, and that's slides 47 and 48. And I can talk about these really together because they really are tied together. What this measure looks at is our ability with respect to projects in terms of bringing those in time and on budget. And as you can see in both of these measures, we have fallen behind or have not been able to achieve the targets that we have out there for ourselves. And the contributing factors to that, to achieving that target, really are in three main areas. First is that we don't have a lot of project management expertise and skills in estimating. A lot of our focus has been on at the developer level and the technical level. The second is that while we haven't established project management and development methodologies, they haven't been totally implemented, and part of that is because it really takes the expertise to understand those things, to implement them. And then third is simply the number of dedicated staff that we have to development projects. And what happens is that as our customers come to us and ask for support, our priorities are constantly shifting from one thing to the next. And so what will happen is we'll get started on a project, we'll start working on that, and then a new, slightly higher priority will come, so we'll abandon that for a while, go and take care of this immediate need, and then have to go back to the other project, which, you know, with any kind of long-term project, anytime you have those starts and stops, there's always this startup period that you have to then redo again. And so those are really the contributing factors to why we haven't been able to be as successful with this particular measure as we'd like to be.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you. Give us a definition of an application project.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I can give you some examples.
Thank you.
For instance, we were working on a new assessment tool for our community corrections section. That was a fairly large project where we were working on having ways that when or a tool that when offenders would leave the institutions and go out to community corrections, they then would use that to be able to identify what their risk to reoffend was, and then they use that information just like we do at intake to then start to form how they're going to manage that individual and what kind of, you know, again, using evidence-based practices, what kinds of interventions might be the most successful with that person while they're on in community corrections. Another one that we worked on, that we have worked on, another example, I mean, there's many of these.
Let me interrupt you. Follow up, please.
Please.
This isn't capital construction type project. This is a internal project, a process evaluation or a determination of a better way to put out a product.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, no, actually we are developing software applications and delivering those based on a business need and delivering those out to our customers that they use to enter data and to that they use to manage their workloads or whatever it may be.
Okay. That creates another follow-up, sorry. So we're creating software.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Now what I'd like to do, those are the measures that I wanted to cover, and again, we have many more measures, internal measures, that both distribution services and facility services use to help manage their day-to-day operations, and I would invite you to take a look at those, and if you have any questions, please feel free to contact me and let me know. What I'd like to do now is spend the bulk of my time on the policy option packages, starting on slide 50. Policy option package 120 is aimed at trying to improve our infrastructure around which we provide support to our customers. And the two basic areas that we're addressing, or the two areas that we are addressing here, are in financial services and information services. And the addition of these positions are, again, tied to the performance measures that I just outlined for you. First is to help us assure that we can have the activities going on throughout the year that will ensure that we are earning that gold star every year. And secondly, in fiscal services, is to pay bills on time. The two positions in information services are dedicated towards bringing projects both on time and on budget. The next slide, slide 51, package 121. This is the groundwater monitoring, which you saw a companion to this earlier in Mr. Zerniak's presentation. That particular package was financing the ongoing operations. This particular package funds the consulting help that we need for doing the groundwater testing throughout the biennium. An independent source that comes in and analyzes, tests the water, and they do that about every other month. Slide 52, package 122. This is a COP financed package. It's a wireless equipment upgrade. In two of our institutions, our Snake River Institution, which is our largest institution, at that institution, many of our radios and radio equipment is approaching 15 years. The normal replacement cycle is about 8 to 10 years. We're in a position actually in both these locations where we don't have enough radios, and we're actually rationing those radios right now. So this package is for replacement of radio equipment at our Snake River facility, as well as additional radios that are needed at Coffee Creek because of the expansion.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question might be to Doug. Doug, the debt service is 883. That's part of the COP package?
No, the debt service would be in a separate section on your budget. But so the debt service on for this current biennium for this $6.5 million of COPs is the $880,000.
That's for the biennium against the 6.5.
Right.
And for that's why the 6.5 shows up as other funds?
Right. When you sell... Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Hamm. When you issue COPs, you issue them as other funds, and then the debt service comes up from whatever funding source, and in this case, it's general fund. Mm-hmm. So you do, in a sense, you're double counting.
Follow up.
Yes.
That's two facilities, I don't know, $3 million a piece. That's a spendy system. Give us a sense of what all that system does there. I mean, I think we're all seeing your folks walking around with handhelds and communicating with one another to the different places. Is it more of a rate? Is this got a base system to it? Or just give us a little better description of that, and maybe when we're doing our tours as well, we could get a little peek at what this might look like.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I'm not the expert in this area, so I'll just try to give you a high-level sketch of what I know anyway. There is, what you see on the surface, the handheld equipment is really just at the surface. There's lots of repeaters, and at each location, we actually have an antenna that's used to communicate that gives us the ability to then have penetration through the walls that we need to be able to communicate across the institution. And the other thing I would say is that the majority of these dollars, or greater than 50% of these dollars, is going to Snake River, which is our largest institution. We have over, or we have around 1,000 employees there.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, I think, as Mr. Kresge pointed out, and we'll be happy to get you sort of a more detailed description of how this breaks out financially in the equipment that's actually being purchased. But one of the complications, obviously, of running radios in a hardened prison system is you're battling the concrete and the structures to be able to get that access and that penetration throughout. As we talked the other day, the Snake River facility is a large facility with a large footprint, and you know, this is one of those, again, one of those safety and security issues where we really need people to be able to communicate with the control center and with each other, and we're just at a point in the life cycle of the radios at that facility that we're, you know, the system that's there is just running out of steam and can't get the job done. But we'd be happy to give you a more, we've got obviously the detailed analysis that built the basis of this funding request, and we're happy to provide that for you and show you how it breaks down. But it is antennas and repeaters and base stations and the handheld units, and probably the software associated with keeping and controlling the system and all the frequency pieces and all the rest of that. And we'll be pleased to show that to you.
Thank you.
Moving on to the final package for General Services, slide 53, package 161, which is our deferred maintenance package. And as you know, Mr. Chair, we've been working very closely with Representative Hanna on this particular package. But what this one does is it addresses, we have had, since 1996, we have established our deferred maintenance list, which we've been keeping track of. And we sort all of our deferred maintenance issues into three different levels, the first being priority ones, which are maintenance items that, if not fixed, could be or have a likely to become a hazardous condition for the health or safety of the institution. So these are the ones in this particular package that we're addressing, those priority one issues. We have issued to Mr. Wilson and to Representative Hanna a list of those priority ones in priority order, and we have been working on those. But they address, as I said, you know, environmental issues, electrical systems, plumbing, roofing, our heating and ventilation kinds of things.
Can I ask you a question about that, Mr. Kresge? Let's see, I'm going to the debt service capital portion on slide 15. It has $1.1 million for the capital improvement portion of the capital construction, and then $34.8 million for capital construction. Is that $1.1 million for capital improvement changed much over time, or is that generally the amount of money you have?
Mr. Chair, it has changed. A couple biennium ago, it was actually, I think, in the neighborhood of about $2 million, and this last biennium, it was essentially cut in half. And Mr. Wilson may have a little more history on that.
Actually, Mr. Chairman of Subcommittee, back in the early part of 01-03, it was, I think, closer to $3 million. And then for the last couple biennium, it had been cut to $1 million. And I would hope, just so you folks understand, capital construction, there are budgeting rules. Capital construction, those larger projects that exceed $500,000 in size. Capital improvements are smaller ones. Capital construction is generally COP financed. Capital improvements generally are not. I use the term generally. There are exceptions in both cases.
Can I ask a question about that? Just so I understand, I mean, you could set aside money in your budget for bigger projects if you like. It's just kind of the tradition that we use COPs for those kinds of things.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that the challenge is, I mean, by setting aside money, I mean, we could certainly make a general fund request. There's nothing, I think, that would stop us from coming in and saying on these deferred maintenance projects we'd like the whole thing in straight general fund cash. I think the reality is, at least given the experience that we've had in trying to address these issues over time, and the more critical nature as we wait, the cost of doing the deferred maintenance goes up, the overall risk to the structures that we're talking about increases. The sense was that it was not going to be something that we were going to be able to get any kind of an approval for. So when we submitted the idea, both through DAS and the governor's office, to do this, most of these projects, and this is the issue that we've been working with Representative Hanna on, the large percentage of the total amount in that $24 million of projects are projects that are going to take a period of time to implement, and putting all the money in through COPs sort of guarantees the cash stream necessary to complete those projects. There are a small handful of those projects, actually a large number, but a small amount of probably between $1 to $3 million that are smaller in size that may, in fact, at some point in the conversation we have with the committee, be the kinds of projects that we ought to be funding out of general fund money and not putting those through a debt-financed approach. The one point that I'd simply like to make is that $1.1 million in that capital improvement amount, we know kind of where a lot of our issues are. You always, in a system like this, there are going to be unanticipated events that occur, a sewer line that breaks somewhere that's going to cost $300,000 or $400,000 to fix, or an inspection on a roof that hasn't been identified that all of a sudden is going to need to be replaced to save both structure and equipment. And what we've typically been doing is not addressing these deferred maintenance projects, but using the small amount of capital improvement money to really be sort of the department's emergency fund for dealing with those immediate must-do kinds of projects. And my recommendation to the committee would be that you continue to leave us a certain amount of money in that category to address those things. In well over $1 billion worth of operating prison stock you've got in this state, there are going to be those moments where we're going to have to fix something that we didn't anticipate.
And before your question, just one more so I understand. Then the 34.8 includes the COP money for capital construction?
Yes.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you'd indulge me a moment, I would give a brief explanation of what we've done. I won't go into the details other than so that everybody on the committee is aware. The agency has been excellent to sit down and visit with us. We've actually met three times, including with Mr. Wilson, yourself, one of those opportunities, two other times. First, to take the book that you all received, which includes those deferred maintenance pieces, prioritized from 1 to 45 each of those items, then created a, and you can't see this, but I'm just displaying it for purposes to know that, created a spreadsheet and began to not only go look at those, which we did yesterday, spent a couple hours out, the places that we could hit locally. Again, Mr. Wilson went, Representative Cameron went, myself, and a number of folks from the agency. And it's our hope, my hope, that I can come back to you and say, we've looked at these projects, we've used the definition that Mr. Wilson used in terms of, are these capital construction projects or are they deferred maintenance that we can get in there? But you have to further delineate that a little bit. Some of the projects that wouldn't traditionally be capital construction, because the cost would be slightly under the $500,000 point, might be a time of completion or a health and safety issue that would bump them up into the higher priority category. So I think given just a little bit more time and a few more meetings, we can have a pretty comprehensive plan and come back with it, with an idea at least, and say, we've been through all of them, and here's something for the committee to look at.
Yeah, and I just want to express publicly how much I appreciate you taking that lead. We look forward to your recommendations, and hopefully we can take those two onto the co-chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that completes my presentation for General Services. I'd be happy to answer any final questions that you may have for me.
Done. Thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you,
Mr. Chair. Your patience, particularly. Ms. Honeywell, would you please come forward?
Chair Shields and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Shalee Honeywell. I'm an assistant director for the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm responsible for the Human Resources Division for the department. Noting that we are trying to stick with getting through this quickly, I would probably just move to slide 3 in the human resources section in the notebook. And just real briefly, I'd like to communicate that the purpose of the Human Resources Division is one really to meet the needs of the department. We're positioning ourselves as a service component in the department. We're partners to the agency and external agencies and other outside entities. And our true vision and purpose is to help create the workforce that's for the Department of Corrections through seeking to be the employer of choice. And we do that, again, through establishing the partnerships that are there. Probably moving past just the organizational structure in slide five, we can, or slide four, we can go to slide five. The Human Resource Division is comprised of eight units. And I'd like to just move to slide six, and I'll just briefly go through each of the eight units to give you an idea of what they are. On slide six, it identifies that one of the units is the Recruitment Diversity and Background Investigations Unit. It's the unit's responsible for all recruitments for the department, providing a diverse and qualified workforce for the department. They also conduct all the background investigations for our correctional series within the department. 505 background investigations have been completed just this biennium. They also are in partnership with the agency in creating our affirmative action plan in cultural competency. Moving on to slide seven is the payroll and benefits unit. They're responsible for processing all the agency-wide payroll. We're still in a manual payroll system at this point in time. We do it by timesheets and entering into the system. They're also responsible for processing all the health, dental, life, and disability claims and safeguards for the department. I know that I believe in Mr. Zerniak's presentation there were questions with regards to the EAP program. And again, just to provide a little additional information for you, the EAP program is the Employee Assistance Program. It's actually a program for all state employees. It's provided through the Public Employee Benefit Board, what we call PEB. It's also provided by Cascade Centers, and it's a counseling service for all employees in state government. In addition to that, though, the Department of Corrections has also a program called the ESS program, and it's the Emergency Staff Services Program. And we do this internally within each institution. We have staff that are ready to respond when there's a critical incident that occurs with our own employees. They're trained to respond, to help them, to counsel them, work with their family members also, to provide support internally to those critical incidents when they occur. Moving on to slide eight is the personal records unit.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why are you handling your own health, dental, life? Why are you handling that and not? And what's ours under PEP? Why are you doing it and not the state, like other state agencies?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, actually, it's the data input into the state system that we manage. We put it into the PEP system, and we still, yes, we are, okay. We're through PEP. I'm sorry for that confusion.
All right.
So slide eight is the personnel records unit. This unit's responsible for maintaining all of the Department of Corrections employee position and medical files. They're also responsible for processing any position-related changes for the employees. That's about 1,000 changes that occur annually within the department. They also deal with the position inventory control systems. That's the PIC systems that we talk about in position management for any state agency. Slide nine, again, is employee relations. This is a very critical function for human resources. It's responsible for really the professional level advice that comes out of the human resource division. This is where all of the human resource managers are in the unit, and they provide direct line services to the rest of the department and interpret state and DOC policies, rules, regulations, and they interpret and apply the collective bargaining agreements for the department. Slide 10 is our labor relations unit, and it's just what it is. They're responsible for managing our five collective bargaining agreements that we have. Those agreements are with two different unions, both an association and AFSCME. They also do the grievance management and the arbitration management for the department, along with just collaborating in a labor relations context for the department. Slide 11 is our professional development unit. Several people refer to this as our training unit. All training is provided out of the professional development unit, such as our new employee orientation, our annual in-service, leadership, skills instructors, training that provide our skills force training, dealing with defensive tactics, armed post qualification. We also develop a training catalog and any agency-specific training for the department. Classification compensation on slide 12 is responsible for position management and employee compensation. We're really partners with the Department of Administrative Services. We have about 140 classifications out of the 1,000 classification system with the Department of Administrative Services. This unit is responsible to implement any of the Department of Administrative Services classification studies and any position change or management change for the department. Safety and risk management is the last unit within the Human Resources Division. It is just what it states. It's developing a safety and risk policy and program for the department. It manages and helps managing, maintaining a healthy workforce, the wellness programs, and also our time loss claims dealing with workers' compensation within the department. The next two slides really outline both the overall funding and where human resources falls within the department, along with identifying that we have 66.25 FTE and our expenditures and how they break out amongst those eight units within the division that I just talked about. The next slide, really, I would move forward, if we could, to slide 17. And I'll just briefly reiterate that the budget drivers for the Human Resources Division are very similar to those in the General Services Division. It's really based upon the growth of the employees, the inmate population, how we manage contract administration with our collective bargaining agreements, and also when there are statewide changes in policy, rule, compensation, classification, and many times being driven by the Department of Administrative Services that will impact our workload.
Excuse me, Ms. Honeywell.
Yes.
So you have 66.2 FTEs now, and do you have any sense of how that's changed over the last two biennia or so?
Yes, Chair Shields, if we can turn to slide 16, I think, is actually a representation.
Oh, of the FTEs. Well, no. Oh, yeah, there it is. Okay, the number. All right, great. So what do you think of 50 in 2003?
Chair Shields and members of the committee, yes, it was about 50. There's been a slight increase over the last three biennium, somewhat moving forward as we've brought on Warner Creek and now moving towards bringing on Madras.
All right, thank you. Please continue.
I think that would move us to slide 18, which I believe that Max covered in his presentation. Director Williams did as far as our key performance measure, 6. However, if I could note, I'd like to take you to slide 20 and just identify, although our time loss claims have increased as far as number of claims over the last three biennium, I would note with this slide that in many ways our total claims paid have almost stayed level. And so it would be our proposal that we had come back during work session and make some proposals around maybe a new performance measure that would recognize looking at claims paid and the cost of the claims associated with time loss claims and not just the number of claims themselves. We feel that there are additional measures.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's your number one time loss claim?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, actually they're associated with slips, trips, and falls are the majority of our claims within the department.
If
follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
And what's the mitigation?
Chair Shields, Representative Hanna, there's ongoing training, both in our in-service and what we do on a daily basis to remind people of good performance on the job with regards to how we respond, what we do, when we're getting in and out of vehicles on mobile patrol. So part of it is that's what we do. It's training and reminding people on an ongoing basis. There's also other things that were triggers this last fiscal year that we saw the increase of some of our time loss claims, such as defensive tactics. On average, we had about 2 claims that came from defensive tactics. We saw 19 this last fiscal year. We saw that we changed the way we performed that training, and now we've altered it, taking it back to what it was prior to last fiscal year, because we felt it impacted what was occurring and why there were time loss claims.
How has your increase in time loss claims affected your premium cost?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, it actually has been a driver. We have seen a gradual increase in our costs associated with our premiums.
Define gradual. I mean, are you having a biennial increase in workers' comp of 15%, or is it 20%? Or give us a sense for what that might be.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I'm not exactly sure what the increase has been. It's typically rolled into a component of the overall DAS risk management assessment, so we can go back and break that out and give you some specifics. I will say that DOC is playing an active role, and I'm playing an active role on the statewide safety initiative that's being sort of managed by DAS to do a lot of work around safety and culture. I think the there's good and bad news, I think, in the data that we're presenting to you today. The bad news is that we've had a sharp increase in the total number of claims. I think the good news is that our claim management process are getting people back to work and into the workplace and shortening the number of time loss days is actually demonstrating itself to be reasonably effective at keeping the overall cost down. But there's no question that the claims numbers have gone up. And as Ms. Honeywell pointed out, the vast majority of our injuries are your basic workplace injuries, slips, trips, falls, strains. There were a couple of highlights, I think, from this last year as we analyzed the data. The training injuries was one example. And we have seen some increase in the number of time loss claims as a result of inmate behavior. It's still a low amount of the total number of claims, but it was a higher amount than in previous bienniums. And so we're going back and evaluating that as well. But we're working on developing an overall approach to address safety as a key component and as a cultural issue within the department in an effort to address this. I would anticipate that as we come back to the committee and talk about adjusting this performance measure in a way that's going to reflect both claims numbers and claims values, that we'll have a decent bit of baseline data and something that we can kind of report on next biennium as to how we've attempted to further mitigate the issues.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly understand you're discussing training because some kinds of injuries are a function of the way an activity is carried out. But I was a little surprised that you didn't, or at least maybe I just didn't hear it as I was thinking about something else. But often we also hear about something connected with the physical environment or equipment or clothing. Is there anything about the physical environment or equipment that we should hear about that's the cause of some of the time loss claims?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathanson, I think that that's one of the issues that we're really trying to drill down into as we analyze this data. There's no question that the physical layout of our institutions, the stairs, the walkways, some of the older institutions, some of the new, the condition, for example, of some of the parking lots. I've heard, anecdotal information from people about just, the destruction or the decay in some of those areas is causing issues as people are walking in. So we have safety managers at each institution that report to the superintendent of that facility. And we do a pretty good job, I think, of trying to analyze the specific instance of the event to determine whether there was something or should be something done to try to prevent it. We shifted on the training side as a new approach to doing that defensive tactics training, and it was a more strenuous approach, and as a result, it caused some additional injury. We're reevaluating how we're going about that, but you know, there's no question that corrections is a certain. There, a lot of these positions require a certain amount of strenuous exercise at various points, and so we're trying to balance the need for people to be prepared and trained accordingly to respond to those situations, but also not create a situation where the training itself is resulting in people getting injured. And that's a standard challenge, I think, in any kind of physical education or physical training in any kind of job event, and it's somewhat of a cost of doing business. But we'll be happy to break down further the specifics around how these claim increases, even if the dollar amount hasn't increased, the claim total increase has had an effect on what our rates have been on our workers' comp risk assessment.
Thank you.
Now if we could move on to slide 21. I would like to just briefly go and turn to the internal measures that we've been using within the division to measure some of the things that we feel impact the workforce. The first one is to recruit, retain, and to promote qualified staff within department. This actually came from the strategic plan for the Department of Corrections, and we've been tracking the average number of days from recruitment to hire for correctional officers. As you can see from the graph, we have gone from about 270 days to 175 days, and we have a goal of having a turnaround of 90 days from really when we receive the application. They go through the background check, the ledge check, taking two online tests, and being interviewed by different locations throughout the department to the place that there's a conditional offer of employment by the department. You can see that we've shaved off 100 days of that. Some of the issues surrounding that is just the way we've done our process, when we've done background investigations in the past, and also obtaining the applications themselves. And meaning completed applications by the applicants. So we're also modifying our current application process so that we can streamline it, we can be more efficient, we can fill vacancies faster, and again, recruit qualified staff and get them on board for the department. Another internal measure is with regards to fostering collaboration amongst managers and staff. We've been tracking now for the last 2 years the grievances that are occurring within the department. We feel that at the most basic level, if we can resolve issues or concerns with our employees, really at the staff level, it really fosters collaboration among staff in the department. So we've been tracking step two grievances per 100 employees. We've gone from 5.28 in 2005 down to 4.82, so we're seeing a decrease there. The last internal measure is with regards to training, and it's supplying, sustaining, and developing a diverse, qualified workforce. In doing so, we changed the way that we were providing in-service within the department in the year 2006. It was called the Enhanced Staff Training Initiative that came out of our strategic plan. We went back to the local environment of every institution doing in-service themselves, training managers for managers to come in and train staff directly. Again, building the relationships of the managers and the staff themselves at the local level. In doing so, you can see some of the statistics that are laid out there in this internal measure, identifying that we did 38 instructor academies with our managers. We did approximately 184 hours of training monthly, in-service classroom hours delivered by those managers. We also implemented in 2006 our Director's Academy, which is a leadership component of training within the department, and have now trained 130 managers within that leadership academy. With that, unless there are any additional questions, I think that concludes the Human Resources Division presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did step out for a moment for that. I'm sorry. Are you going to provide us at any time like a turnover rate? I mean, you show how long it takes to get somebody here, but how about your turnover rate?
I'm Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna. Actually, I have that today. I could briefly share that with you, or I could also provide it in a follow-up document.
Follow-up. You have it here? It's in the book? Or
it's
you
not
just
in
have
the book. I have it in front of me that I could share.
Mr. Chair, at your indulgence, just a couple of numbers on that. I don't know how far you're trying to get today. So
we're trying to roll as quickly as we can, if you wouldn't mind talking to her after.
Mr. Chair, and we can go ahead and pull, and I think we have shared this with Representative Cameron, so that stated may already be with Mr. Wilson, or if it's not, it's probably coming. But we've got a sheet that can lay out turnover, not only compared by the department, compared to other agencies within state government, and compared to other departments of correction around the country where we've been able to get the data. And we'll be happy to put that in a sheet and provide it to you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Chair, as they switch speakers real quickly, on since there were questions about worker comp costs, state is self-insured using Risk Management Division, and the rates are based on, I think it's a six-year moving average. So, you know, you saw 3 years of relatively stable there. That will be reflected in their rates. In some years, you'll have a spike, and that's the reason it's a six-year or multi-year. I think it's six-year. I'm not sure of that. So you'll see variances in those rates based on that.
Ms. Peters.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am Colette Peters, Assistant Director, responsible for the Public Services Division and the Inspector General. I would like to begin by giving a brief overview of the Public Services Division so that you have a general understanding of what we do. A primary role of the Public Services Division is gathering, analyzing, and providing the vast amounts of information needed to make decisions in Oregon's largest public safety agency. We are charged with building strong relationships with DOC's broad spectrum of stakeholders and partners, both within and beyond the realm of public safety. As you can see, if you turn to slide 4 on our organization chart, we are composed of 6 units. As Assistant Director, I oversee these units as well as serve as the agency's Inspector General, as you will see in the following slides. As the Inspector General, I have authority to investigate and examine the actions of all agency employees and inmates, including criminal activity. In this role, I hold broad responsibility for oversight of suspected, alleged, or actual misconduct within the department, reporting objectively to the director. As Inspector General, I also serve as the department's liaison with external law enforcement and criminal justice agencies. The DOC Special Investigations Unit is the largest in the division, comprising nearly half of our staff. It is charged with investigating alleged wrongdoing by inmates and staff, including criminal investigations of inmates, in cooperation with the Oregon State Police and the district attorneys serving the counties in which we have prisons. The hearings unit provides due process hearings for inmates, including those accused of misconduct, to determine what, if any, sanctions will be imposed. Now, if you'll turn to slide 9, I'd like to talk about the Office of Project Management. As the agency grows, so does the size, number, and complexity of its projects. Professional project management is an important component of moving the department forward in identifying and accomplishing its goals and strategic plans. The unit of 2 staff is responsible for directly overseeing large projects and for training, mentoring, and monitoring others who have project management responsibilities as part of their other work duties. The Office of Public Affairs is the department's information bureau, responsible for a wide array of communication functions, including media and government relations, publications, reports, and official responses, internet website content, citizen and legislative inquiries and surveys, public records requests, and rulemaking. Now, if you turn to slide 11, I'd like to share with you some information regarding the Research and Evaluation Unit, which we have heard Chair Shields speak of throughout the presentation. As you all know...
Before you go on, can I ask you a question? In the Public Affairs Department, you've got 8 positions there. Do you know how that's changed over time?
Yes. And if you turn to... I don't have that slide there. That unit has changed just recently, this June, when the Public Services Division was created. The unit had consisted of a smaller group, and then we brought in a central function that was reporting directly to the director, as well as the rules section. So last June, I believe the unit consisted of 5 individuals, and now it's 8, but has taken on additional responsibilities.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I believe that was internal staff, though.
It was.
It was
existing
new positions.
Staff.
It was positions in other parts of the agency that were combined into that unit.
That's right. Thank you for the clarification.
And just to follow up, so are they doing more than just communications, or what?
Yes, we have the communications part of the staff that I know that you're familiar with, Mr. Chair, and then also a central support function and a rulemaking function. So those have also been wrapped into the Office of Public Affairs.
Mr. Chair, if I could just jump in, we did do a reorganization last June and streamlined a number of direct reports to the director's office, and as we realigned that, that hearings function was placed, or not only the hearings function, but the rulemaking function was placed in this public services division, along with the special investigations unit and the inspector general's role. So we've sort of combined them all in a single division, and so in doing that, that rulemaking function moved into the public affairs office.
Thank you. Please continue.
So as you well know, decision makers and public safety agencies are increasingly turning to evidence-based practices to make decisions regarding program funding. Those decisions can be only as good as the evidence on which they are based. That is where the DOC Research and Evaluation Unit plays a pivotal role, facilitating informed decision making. Several times during our presentation, as I mentioned before, you have heard Chair Shields reference Dr. Paul Bilotti, who heads this unit. He and his staff are responsible for providing all of you, DOC leadership, and other criminal justice partners with mission-critical data for Senate Bill 267 compliance, offender populations and trends, recidivism rates, and other operational components of our work. This information is vital to help ensure the department operates in a cost-effective manner and in support of its missions and goals. If you turn to slide 12, you can see the Public Services Division is a small segment of the Oregon Department of Corrections pie at less than 1%, but as I have already outlined today, it serves a vital central function that crosses divisional and agency lines. This next slide shows you the distribution of our 69 positions in the governor's recommended budget. And if you turn to slide 14, on this page, you will see that our budget history is short. As Director Williams pointed out, the division was actually created this last June. Note that the scale of this chart, then, is a bit deceptive. What would be a high trajectory of growth with a larger division now represents a requested increase of only 6 positions in our small division. Now, if you'll turn to slide 15 that speaks to budget drivers. As a service division for the department, our principal budget driver is growth in our workload because of growth in the inmate population and concurrent growth in staff. Director Williams covered the agency key performance measures in detail during his presentation, and I would only add to his comments by noting that the Public Services Division supports the work of the agency in the key areas listed on slides 16 and 17. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that concludes my brief presentation of the Public Services Division. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you may have.
Perfectly timed. Thank you, Ms. Peters. Any questions, colleagues? All right, let's keep rolling.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mitch Marr. I'm the Deputy Director of the agency. I'm here to present to you and obviously the members of the committee on central administration and the debt service, capital improvement, and capital construction portions of the presentation material. I'll move quickly, but obviously if there's questions, feel free to ask, and I'll stop. In the central administration section, if you'll turn to page 3, it kind of gives you a general purpose statement of central administration, and that's to provide leadership, to plan, to coordinate activities across divisions, to strengthen internal and external communication, and I would add to that relationships, and to provide for fiscal and ethical accountability. Central administration on slide 4 and 5, that we have 5 units in the central administration, which includes the director's office, department overhead, internal audits, planning and budget, and population management. The next few slides kind of go into detail around each one of those units. What I'm going to take you to is actually to slide 9 and talk a minute about population management specifically. This office came into being in the June 06 reorganization. We think it's a critical component for the agency. I provided Doug with a couple handouts that he'll share with you folks. One deals with the prison management alert system. A second one deals with how our classification ties into the forecasting that's done by the Department of Administrative Services. But basically, this particular unit within central administration is responsible for the development and implementation of department-wide population management strategies. And the bottom line is to ensure the right inmate in the right bed at the right time. They play a critical role for us. There's a lot going on, a lot of complexity. And we have somebody in this office, a sergeant in this office, has probably got about 28 years experience in the business and is doing a tremendous job in aligning what we do as an agency with regard to managing the 13,000 plus inmates that we have. There's no questions, so I'll keep moving. I think it's important to note the department overhead section on slide 10. That's about 82% of the central administration budget at about $37 million. These charges impact all the divisions, but we manage that cost centrally. Don't know if there's any questions specifically about that or not.
Mr. Chair, I'll just make a brief point on that if I could. Those are the charges and assessments essentially that were assessed by the Department of Administrative Services or any other centrally assessed charges for the department. So those are, we hold those in this division. So when people do look at the administration number, they sometimes get a sense that that's a lot of money in administration. It's simply that we hold the department overhead in that unit. And as Mr. Moore pointed out, it makes up about 80% of the unit's overall dollar association.
I think I need just a moment to make sure I understand how that works. Mr. Wilson tried to explain it to me, but I wasn't quite sure about it. So the those type of charges would be AG charges for lawsuits, for legal representation, for DAS. But
Mr. Chair, I think the AG charges are included in that. I'm not sure they are included, but they also include the charges that fund many portions of DAS, including Ms. Gilbert, who's at the table, Secretary of State, Central Service. Probably includes the charges for the information management division at DAS, whatever share of central government service charges, and in fact, indirectly funds portions of the legislature too. So it is a collection of various central service that charges that the department has little control over. And that in some agencies' budgets, they're spread throughout divisions. In this agency, they've made the determination they want to manage that or show that centrally.
And, Mr. Chair, we can provide you a breakdown of that.
That's unnecessary. I wanted to make sure that I understood it.
All right. Moving to slide 11, you can see the pie charts that depict expenditures by program and FTE. Slide 12 give you pie charts that have the unit-specific expenditures and then the FTE by program. Slide 13 is the budget history of central administration. And then the budget drivers specifically for central administration, and I'll summarize them, basically are regard personnel services, department overhead, which we've talked about, and then population management, which actually involves some level of rental bed activity within the agency.
Before you continue, colleagues, can we go for about another 5 minutes? All right, please continue.
I'm going to skip through the performance measures. As Ms. Peters pointed out, Mr. Director Williams talked about all these in the overview. Take you right to slide 25, policy option package 140. This has been discussed somewhat in committee today. This is the issuance costs for the COPs, and a total about $1 million. And those tie back to the deferred maintenance, planning and design, wireless, and the Salem SDC costs. So if there's no questions, I will move into debt service, capital improvement, and capital construction. Thank you. The purpose, obviously, of debt service is a legal liability to repay borrowed funds, typically for COPs or certificates of participation, which then apply to expansions, deferred maintenance, or new construction. And the debt service is computed by the Department of Administrative Services. Slide 4 kind of gives you a breakdown of debt service within the pie. It totals about $133 million. That $133 million includes the $3.5 million of newly requested COPs and the debt service associated with it. Slide 5 is expenditures by program, and there's the 3.5 at the lower portion of the pie chart on slide 5. Slide 6 gives you the budget history with regard to debt service. And there's about 13.3% increase from 05-07 to 07-09. The graph you see on slide 7, I think, has been presented to the committee once before. I'd be happy to answer any question, but it reflects the biennial debt service obligation of the agency, and then it also provides you information on outstanding balances prior to January of 07, and then what the new balances would look like if, in fact, new debt service is approved. Slide 8 gives you kind of a spreadsheet of that debt service. It's just another way to depict it. There are about 10 refinance activities as you walk through that chart, but it gives you the history of what, you know, the projects that the monies were used for, sale description, and then obviously when the debt retires. There is one policy option package with regard to debt services policy option package 140, construction debt service and related costs. And that is a $3.5 million. And again, that's tied to the wireless planning and design, deferred maintenance, City of Salem, and McGath Road firing range.
Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I do have a question, and this is for Doug Wilson. In slide 8, Doug, what's the funding relationship from Department of Corrections for Wapato?
Mr. Chair, Senator Representative Hanna, as part of Senate Bill 1145, the decision was made that the state would finance the construction of jail facilities, giving that opportunity to every single county. I'm not sure how it was distributed, but you'll find that a significant share of the debt service and the COP financing for the last 10 years, roughly, did include construction dollars for most every county, for either a jail, a portion of the jails, or for work release centers and those kinds of things.
Follow up?
Yes.
So should we assume then that this is the debt service that was allowed through COP sale, however that entity is repaying that debt?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe my analysis, and I'm going to look at Mr. Allen to make sure that I'm right when I say this, but I believe that in that $133 million of debt service that's currently reflected in the governor's recommended budget, about $16 million of that $133 million is the department covering the repayment of debt service to the various counties around the state who opted to go ahead and do construction under Senate Bill 1145. So not only did the state provide the option for the COP funding, but I believe the state continues to bear the debt service responsibility for those projects, and it amounts to about $16 million of our $133 million. And that's not part of the community corrections formula allocation. That just sits in that debt service component that's associated with the repayment responsibilities of the department.
Dave, can I ask one question before you go? So maybe this question for Mr. Allen. Looking at this number, it says $8.5 million by sale. I assume that's money still owed for Wapato to pay. And
current balance.
Do we have a sense of, I mean, if you had to ballpark it, what percentage of Wapato does the state own or pay for, and what percentage does the county own or pay for?
Mr. Allen's recollection, Mr. Chair, is that we financed about a third of that project. We'd be happy to get you the details. I'm confident we could put together a list of all the county projects and what the total initial amount of the financing was. Most of the counties contributed some portion, obviously, of that funding, and the state provided some. And that was, again, part of that long-standing agreement that was made with 1145, that, you know, knowing that they would have to house some of those offenders locally, that there would be resources made available for that.
And just to follow up, we don't actually then own a third of Wapato. It's just we paid for them to have a third of.
Yes, Mr. Chair. There is no ownership interest in any of these specific projects.
Chair, I think we need to be careful with that. I think they're actually in the bond in the COP certificates. There's something there. So, I think as the bonds are paid off, the county takes ownership, so you need to be careful.
Yeah, I guess and I'm certainly no bond lawyer, Mr. Chair, so I may have misspoke myself. What I will say is that when the two counties that did opt out of 1145, and we worked through the arrangements with those counties to determine how we were going to manage the fact that the state had made investments in those jail expansions, I remember a conversation with a particular sheriff who said, yeah, you own the third floor, but I still own the front door. we always work to find an accommodation with those folks that we're negotiating with.
You could always bring a ladder. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Chair Shields. As it applies to Wapato, since I think they're still, it's not operational, is that correct?
That's correct.
What, follow up, would we have changed our participation model given that, I mean, we've all done something we'd like to take back one day, but would we change the model now that if we participate, there would be ongoing funding for operations, or is that just too tough to tie together?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hanna, I think it's too tough to tie together. Part of the belief around Senate Bill 1145 and the concept of local control and making the state's debt services available to assist these counties in needed and necessary jail expansions at the time was, again, to allow them local control options. And so decisions about what they could and couldn't afford to build versus what they could ultimately then afford to finance and operate were really decisions that were left to the counties. There was a formula of some sort that determined how much and what level the state would participate in these projects on. And again, we continue to honor our obligations and pay our portion of the debt service on a biennial basis as part of the department's overall assessment.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr.
Before
Chair.
Before we ask another question, because we're formulating them.
Okay, I'm going to move to the capital improvement section real quickly. And on slide 10, Mr. Koreski talked about this a little bit in his presentation. This is for those unexpected events. It's for project costs or for projects that are under the $500,000 mark. I would point out to the committee that we have approximately 4.6 million square feet of institution space in the department. That equates to about $1 billion investment in real property. Capital improvement helps us maintain that real property. So it's critical, I think, for the agency that we do capital improvement type projects. You'll see the pie chart on slide 11. It's about 1.1 million or 0.1% of the budget, and then by program, it's about 0.6% of the budget. Moving to slide 13, you can see the budget history with regard to capital improvements. That was talked about as well. I think, as Mr. Wilson pointed out, it was a little over $3 million, 0103. I think we only spent about 1.8.
Actually, the legislature, Mr. Chair, cut it back in the one of any special sessions during the
okay.
period.
All right. So I'll leave that one alone then. Third unit, then, on slide 14 is capital construction. The purpose for capital construction, obviously, is to provide safe and secure housing for the inmate populations, new facilities, expansion of existing facilities, and it also, with regard to this budget, has to do with major deferred maintenance projects or remodels. Slide 15, again, shows you the expenditure by program, capital construction being $34.8 million, and that's other fund money. Slide 16 gives you expenditure by program. And then slide 17 gives you the budget history with regard to capital construction. My understanding of this particular bar chart is that the DOC, the DOC did not request any authority for construction funding or new project funding in the 0305-07 budgets. That's why that space is empty. We are now making a request for funding, and that's a $10.5 million for the planning and design of the new facility, and, of course, a $24 million in the deferred payments. For capital construction, there is no base budget. Funding for these new projects is requested in policy packages, and is typically financed by CLPs. I'm going to move past the budget drivers. I think they're well understood. It's based on population forecasting. Obviously, market conditions come into play, and then the existing or the status of the existing facility integrity, which ties back to the deferred maintenance. So, and I'm going to move right to the policy option packages. I'm on a slide 20. First one being policy option package 160. This is the planning and design of the next facility. I think it's important to note for the committee, this is not a request to build another prison. This is a request to begin the process. It takes about 4 to 4.5 years to get a prison on the ground. And based on the forecast, we will need another institution by the end of 2012 to early 2013. We do not want to get behind that curve because then we'll find ourselves in a situation that we found ourselves as an agency when I worked in the institutions in the 80s and 90s where we were putting inmates where we could find an empty space. It's unsafe for the inmates, it's unsafe for the staff, and probably more importantly, or as importantly, I shouldn't say more importantly, we lose focus on what our priorities are, which is to really provide inmates the programming that we think is critical, whether it be transition, reentry program, alcohol and drug, whatever the case may be. When you find yourself over in a crowding situation, you're trying to get through the day, and really your priorities begin to change. We are asking that you allow us to move forward with the planning design portion of this budget. And the last
question about that. So the majority of that money would go to fund positions that are currently within the Department of Corrections. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, no. There's five positions that are in this 10.5. Well, so I don't know the breakdown of what each one of the elements are with regard to the 10.5, but there's wetland and engineering issues that have to be dealt with, road, water, sewer, storm, electrical, and gas design, design around the median facility. There's a 10% contingency, but there is five staff in this particular package. That's correct. The last policy option package, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you want me to go into it. You've heard about this. This is the deferred maintenance and assessment package. It's the $24 million. Representative Hanna has been very involved in this process. So I'm not sure if you want me to get into a lot of detail. It's been discussed.
Yeah, I think we've hit them, and I would hate to keep the committee much longer if you feel comfortable wrapping up at this point.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
We do, Mr. Chair, and we know and we appreciate the fact that we weren't joined by any senators this afternoon. So I just want to assure the committee that recognizing that we've got probably a long time between now and the time we actually go to work session on this budget, we're going to make ourselves available. I'm hoping to have individual meetings with all the committee members to find out if there are any other issues we need to discuss with them. And we'll make a point to try to circle back through and touch base with the senators on the points that were made in today's meeting in an effort to make sure that they have the information and that we've answered any of their questions before we come back into work session. We'll continue to provide you the answers to the questions that you've raised, hopefully here in just the next few days. We'll wrap up the details on those and provide them to Mr. Wilson. And I just want to thank the committee for their interest. We know we've spent a lot of time in front of you this last 3 weeks, and we appreciate your patience with us. And we look forward to continuing to work with you throughout the remainder of the session.
Thank you. And I know that I speak for the committee when I let you know that we appreciate your patience with us as well. Thank you very much. You all did a nice job.
Thank you.